Before we get going, I do just want to thank you for thanks for being a place where we can have these kind of conversations. And it feels healthy. It doesn't feel out of place or off. So I know a lot of pastors who were fearing this morning because they were like, how do we even talk to our church about this? What are we supposed to do? What are you going to do? I'm like, talk about it? Like, what else? But it's just not normal for some churches to have that kind of conversation. So I'm thankful for you. I remember staying up this week, and it was probably about 3 a.m. when they made that call, and Secretary Clinton decided she wasn't going to come out for the concession speech. And there was part of me that was really frustrated. It's like, if you lost, just lose and say you lost. And then there was another part of me that thought, boy, the waiting on that was a very, very wise decision. A very, very wise decision because, how do you even explain? I mean, no one thought President-elect Trump was going to win, not even Hillary. And so when something you've worked your whole life for, a position that you have worked so hard to attain to, gets taken away and almost feels like it gets stolen, how do you even respond to that? What do you even say? And I think for us, it's easy for us to say, well, you just say congratulations. It's not that easy. I mean, when you find out someone in your family has a major illness, could you imagine someone putting a microphone to your face within minutes saying, so what do you think? What? And so when she came out at noon on Wednesday, and she gave her concession speech, if you've not had the opportunity to listen to this speech, I would highly encourage you, go listen. Go listen. It was humble. It was extremely articulate. It was a beautiful, beautiful speech that called for unity. And there was a phrasing in there that she used that she was talking about the peaceful transfer of power in our country. And I found it very, very important. And if you missed it, here's what she said. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. We don't just respect that. We cherish it. It also enshrines the rule of law, the principle that we are equal in rights and dignity, freedom of worship and expression. We respect and cherish these values too, and we must defend them. We have a government that wants to transfer power peacefully from one president to the next. And if you've grown up in the United States like I have, I think we take this for granted. We take this transfer of authority, this transfer of who's leading this entire mess of a country, and it changes every 4 to 8 years, and we see this as normal. This is not normal in comparison to the rest of the world that we live in. I mean, think about it. If you're a student of history, how many times has someone worked for a position of authority to lead a country, and it doesn't end well? I mean, you want to talk about a transfer of power, especially when we talk about monarchies, when they go to children and then children are killing each other so that they can be next in line. Why? Because they want to get the power. They want to have the authority. The peaceful transfer of power is usually like a bullet. That's how it happens in many of these countries because it's not as smooth as we have here. It's amazing to me that we can transfer power peacefully. Even when the authority doesn't agree. When President Bush was passing the baton to President Obama, you want to look at two people who had hugely different philosophies on politics? These two had it. And we don't talk about how horrible of a transition it was. You see, power is a funny thing. Because in a culture, our culture now, we are constantly jockeying for position. We are looking for almost any way to gain power and to gain authority. And this happens in all sorts of structures. If you work in a major business, you constantly are playing the authority and the power politics. If you work for a school, You see this happening constantly. People jockeying for positions of leadership. And it could be in your department. It could be with teachers. It could be in your classroom with class moms. Have you ever seen class moms trying to jockey to be whose class mom? Why would you put more work on your plate? But we do. Why? Because it's a sense of power. It's a sense of authority. This happens in families, in marriages. Let me stop there for a second. In marriages, do you know that there's a jockeying for position and authority? This happens. Teenagers, young adults, your friends, you are constantly jockeying who's in control of our group. We all have this power, this authority, and this is the culture that we live in. And so what we do is we use all the talents, all the skills, and all the resources that we have to gain as much authority and power as we can. And when we gain that power and authority, we do everything we can to hang on to it. I like what Henry Nouwen, who he's one of my favorite authors ever. He has a book called The Life of the Beloved, and we're reading this as a staff right now. It's amazing. He says this in the book. It's sad to see that in our highly competitive and greedy world, we have lost touch with the joy of giving. We often live as if our happiness depends on having. It's really hard to find joy when we're concentrating on getting more. And I believe that this morning, that in a competitive culture bent on gaining power, Jesus calls us to live generously and to give it away. And I feel confident saying that because Jesus doesn't just say that, he demonstrates it. Jesus demonstrates giving power and authority away. And so what I'd like to do this morning is to look at two passages where we see this demonstrated with Jesus. And if you're here this morning and you're trying to figure out your faith and you would not call yourself a Christian and you keep saying to yourself, Jimmy, you're mentioning Jesus a whole lot, let me just explain to you really quickly who Jesus is. And for those of you who would claim that this is what you want to do with your life is pursue Jesus Christ, let me remind you as well of who we're talking about here. And to remind you, I want to go into Colossians chapter 1 and just use the Bible and their description of who Jesus is, okay? This is how Jesus is described. You ready? Starting in verse 15. The Son, and this is Jesus they're talking about, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he's the head of the body, the church, and he's the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. Now this is Jesus. I know a lot of times when we talk about Jesus, we talk about like lovey hippie Jesus. You know, the Jesus that's like, let's love everyone, and he's doing so with a sheep on his shoulders. Right? You know the Jesus I'm talking about. And he sits and he teaches and let's get everyone. That's great. That is a wonderful picture of the love of Jesus. But when we're talking about Jesus, we've got to remember that he is absolutely 100% non-negotiable in charge. All authority, all power, everything resides and lives with him. He wins. This last word here, supremacy, in Colossians 1:18, when you look in the Greek. I love this. It's got the word picture of first place. It's the like Olympics stance where you put first place up on top and they get the medal. This is Jesus, just so we're all on the same page. This is the Jesus we're talking about, is first place Jesus. All authority, all power, it's all Jesus. So if you're here and you're like, yeah, but I can get more power. You can. You can gain all the power this world has to offer, and it still will be second place. You can't get first. First is taken. There's no getting first. There is no one with more power, more authority that has, or there's no one with more power and more authority than Jesus Christ. That's it. That's it. Colossians 1:15-18. a beautiful passage to demonstrate this. So let's not just take this hippie Jesus. It's like, yeah, cool. But I want this Colossians 1 Jesus, this right there, that all things hold together in him, that verse 17, it just blows my mind. This is who Jesus is. Everything holds together because of him. This is the Jesus we're going to look at in Matthew chapter 10 today. In Matthew chapter 10. So if you have your Bibles with you, I'd love for you to turn to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew is the first book in the New Testament written by a tax collector, and he was a follower of Jesus, one of his 12 disciples. And it'll be about three quarters of the way through your Bible if you have a paper one, and about three quarters down on your app if you're using your phone or a tablet. And as you're turning there, what I love about the Gospel of Matthew and up to this point in chapter 10 is Jesus picks out 12 disciples. And these 12 disciples, this is a ragtag group of tax collectors, fishermen, and tradesmen. Jesus comes on the scene as a teacher, and teachers got to pick their disciples, the people that followed them, and they usually picked young boys because they could really mold them and teach them. Jesus picks already professional tradesmen, and he picks the group of people that everybody else passed over. Okay, if you're doing a fantasy draft, this is like round 13 to 15 picks where you're like, does it even matter? I mean, it's a kicker. No one wants that. That's what we're talking about here, unless you're my wife who picks like defense in round 5. You're going to beat me this week, so it's okay. That's who Jesus goes and picks. This is your 13 to 15 range. It's still draftable, but you don't expect these guys to play. They're filling your bye week. And so Jesus has this group, and he's been teaching in front of them, telling everybody about the kingdom of heaven and what's coming. He's been healing people. He's been casting out demons. All of these things are happening, and the disciples get to be part of it. They're watching it all. And at the end of chapter 9, Jesus looks out, and he sees a field that has all this harvest, and something needs to be done about it. And he looks at his disciples and he says, there's so much work that needs to be done. So much work for the kingdom of heaven. There's just no one to go do it yet. And that's the moment I imagine the disciples looking at him and shaking their head, being like, yeah, I wish there was people to go do something about this. It's like when you tell someone in your house, the dishwasher's really, really full and clean and needs to be emptied. And they're like, yeah, someone should empty that. I gotta go. That's what I imagine the disciples looking at right now. Like, hey, I see what you're saying. That's a problem. And so Jesus puts the rubber to the road, and it's about time to get going. This is what he says in Matthew chapter 10. Verse 1, so Jesus called his 12 disciples to him, and he gave them authority to drive out impure spirits and to heal every disease and sickness. Well, that just escalated quickly, didn't it? There's a lot of work to get done. Yeah? You've been watching. You've been hanging out. You've been helping. But now Jesus calls them over, and he does what? What are those three words right here on the second line? Okay, talk to me. What are those three words? He gave them authority. He gave them authority. Jesus calls them, and he doesn't say, I need you to go do something. Look, the harvest is out there. Go do something. No. He gives them authority. And he's the one who's been doing everything, right? It's all been Jesus. He's number one, Colossians 1, right? He's first place. And now he's saying to them, I need you to do this. And not just little this. I mean, we're talking about driving out impure spirits and healing every disease and sickness. Yeah, no pressure, guys. No pressure. This is what he's called them to do. He's sharing in his authority. He's giving it to them, freely giving it to them. They've paid nothing for this. They've demonstrated no behavior that would say you are so deserving of this power and authority. And in verses 2 to 4, You get a list of the 12 disciples, and I think it's Peter and Andrew are listed first, and then you'll see a comma, and then two more and a comma. And that's because if you look also into Luke chapter 10, Jesus again sends out a group of 72 there, and he always sends people out in pairs. He never sends them out alone. We are meant to exercise power, authority with each other. We're supposed to live life together. If you live a life with Jesus in complete solitude, you will be missing out on one of the biggest blessings. Jesus sends his disciples out two by two. And so community is part of the way that Jesus makes up the church. We have to do this together. And so he sends them out. And we're going to pick it up in verse 5. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. Here's their marching orders, right? Do not go among the Gentiles or enter any town of the Samaritans. That sounds weird, doesn't it? Go rather to the lost sheep of Israel, and as you go, proclaim this message. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, drive out demons. Freely you have received, freely give. Now, at first, when you hear this, it seems quite exclusionary, doesn't it? Like, why would Jesus say, don't go to those people? Don't go to the Gentiles and the Samaritans? That seems really weird to me. And I want to clear it up because sometimes it's easy to think, well, God didn't care about them. Or Jesus didn't want that to happen. And it's not that he didn't want them to know the story and to be healed and to have their dead rise and leprosy claimed and demons flying. It wasn't that. You see, the disciples have been given power and authority. And when you've been given power and authority, sometimes you want to go for the easy win, right? The easy way to say, look, I'm doing something well. And Jesus, up to this point, any time that he's gone from town to town and city to city, the places that he has seen the largest groups and the largest gatherings are in places where there were non-Jews, which are Gentiles, or Samaritans, half-Jews. In those places, we see full cities coming to know Jesus, understanding and believing what he said. And so when Jesus says to the disciples, I don't want you to go there, it's not because he doesn't care about them, but because he needs to keep the disciples focused right now. Don't go for the easy win. I need you to go to where it's going to be difficult. And this lost nation of Israel, this is a hard place to minister. And that's where they're going to be called to go. And so with new authority and with new power, they're ready to go. They're calling, verse 8, it's now to heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, and drive out demons. Let me just let that settle in. Those are some pretty huge tasks. Up to this point, they've done none of this. First place Jesus has done all of this. They've watched, but they haven't done it. To send them out seems risky, doesn't it? I mean, don't you want to have a couple practice rounds? Be like, hey, he's got a cold. Let's start there. Not that guy's dead. Let's raise him. It just seems like a big jump to me. I wrestle with this passage. And when I read this, it's hard for me because I don't always like letting other people join me in what I do good at. I wrestle with that sometimes because I think it's a fear thing and I think it's a control thing at the same time. I fear because I wonder if I'm good at something, what if they're better at me than it? Or what if they're better at whatever we're doing than I am? What if I no longer am really good because my value's in some of that stuff, and if I invite someone to join me in it and they're better, then I'm not as good. And I like to feel good at something. And it's a control thing too. What if I invite them to help me with this and it goes all wrong? What if it goes wrong and I'm left cleaning up a mess? What if it takes longer? It's just more efficient if I do it. I think about this when it comes to my kids, when I'm making dinner or loading the dishwasher. It really is. It's just easier if I do it. The food tastes better. The dishes are all in right. everything's better if I do it. But I know the moment that I take the stool out and I invite my kids to step up on the stool to the stove, it's like they're entering the adult world. And then when you say, here's how you turn on the stove, and they're like, what? Click, 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 poof. And their eyes light up because they've made fire. Right? And then they wonder why the pot doesn't boil as quickly as they expect it to. And you're like, well, you can't watch it. Let's look over here. And they put salt on some vegetables, and you know it's too much. So you plant a little extra water at dinner. And they need to flip some sort of meat, whatever that is, that night. And when they flip it, it splatters a little bit. But for some reason, they feel like they're in control. They feel a sense of authority. And then when dinner's over, or when you eat dinner, it's amazing. They'll always eat a dinner they cook, even when it tastes bad. And then you move to the sink, and there's all these dishes, and you're like, I need your help. Would you help load this? And for the first couple times, it's not after that, but you get the first couple. When they step up and they start to drive for that first time, they're like, I'm doing adult things. I am stepping into the adult world. I am almost like an adult. There's a power. There's an authority. Would it be easier for me to do it by myself? Oh, it would be. But that's a control issue. When I release the power and the authority that God's given to me and I'm training and releasing my kids to learn, they walk differently. They made dinner and they want everyone to eat it and they want everyone to know it because they are proud. They've done something with the authority that they've been given. I don't know the situation that they're going into, but I do know that Jesus wasn't worried. I do know that Jesus had no fear of them stealing his thunder because he was the one that did all of this stuff, that the mess that they might make. But I wonder if the disciples felt like kids coming to the stove, where they were now having the ability to heal the sick, to raise the dead, to cleanse those who have leprosy, to drive out demons, and they boldly proclaim the kingdom of heaven, because that's what Jesus has said. I want you to teach on this, but go with power and authority, because they've seen Jesus do it. They've watched him. They've modeled it. And now these things that we see listed, these are things that people would have paid good money to have happen to their families in that day and age. I mean, shoot, we pay a lot of money to have this stuff done now. How much do we pay out of our annual salaries to heal the sick in our own house? People would have paid big for this. And it's no mistaking that Jesus says at the end of verse 8, freely you have received, freely give. Freely you have received, freely give. This isn't about accumulating. This isn't about gathering. This is not about anything like that. This is about giving. And Jesus freely gives them authority. And he calls them to freely give that power away, because he's invited them up to the stove, and now he's releasing them to go. They are called to generous living, to give away the power and the authority that they've been given freely. And I know some of you right now are thinking, yeah, but Jimmy, I've tried this, and I've gotten burned. I've been taken advantage of because I gave freely, and then people just took advantage of it. I understand that. I really do. And I think Jesus does too, because over the next couple of verses, he lays out some great practical ways that we can kind of guard against that and being taken advantage of. But my favorite is in verse 16, when he says, I'm sending you out like sheep among the wolves. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. Jesus, who's known as the shepherd, is taking his sheep and he says, I know where I'm sending you. This is not going to be easy. You're going to the wolves. You need to be very wise. And when he uses this word shrewd as snakes, this phrase here, what a wonderful verse to memorize here. This shrewd as snakes is, the other word for that is like wisdom or prudence. There needs to be some common sense to the gifts and the talents that God's given us and the authority that we have and how we use it. Now, if it's all prudence, it's going to quickly degenerate into just like a cheap cunning that allows us to quickly get the job done instead of really thinking about what needs to be done. So there needs to be a balance of innocence and purity. And so we think as shrewd as snakes, we're planned and we're calculated on one side. But then there's this innocence. And if it's all innocence, we're always getting taken advantage of. So there has to be a balance of saying, God, what would you do in this situation? Did you know there's times God turned people away? He was wise enough that Jesus is like, this is not the time for this gifting. I am not going to assert authority or power here. I need to step away. We talked about that last week. Whenever someone came to Jesus broken, with the right heart, he always healed them. But when they came with arrogance looking for a handout, he never met them there. It's very interesting. It's wisdom and purity. So I pray that we would be wise as serpents and gentle or as innocent as doves in that. But Jesus demonstrates this. So it leaves me asking the question for us today. How do we demonstrate it? What do we do to look like Jesus in this situation? Well, we can say to the disciples, go, and we can do what Jesus said to us. Now we can go. The first thing that we can do is to recognize where our power comes from. You got to remember, I know some of you, you work tireless hours to be in the positions you're in. You work so hard to gain power and authority. It's blood, sweat, tears, and I'm so thankful you've worked hard to be where you are. But you got to remember, God's given you a skill and a talent to do that. And any authority and power that you have or I have has been given to us by Jesus. He's number one. You can work as hard as you want. You will not be number one. So recognize that whatever position you're in is a gift from God. Yes, you've worked hard, and thank you for doing that. I believe you've honored God by working hard. But this isn't by your own doing. Don't be mistaken. Please don't think more highly of yourselves, nor should I, about the authority that's been put in our hands and in our life. This is a God thing. We've got to recognize where our power comes from, and that's in every level of life. So maybe that's helpful in just stopping in whatever position and saying, God, thank you for the fact that I am a mom or a dad today. That's a position of authority. How am I loving my kids better and giving them some authority instead of, go clean your room. Why? Because I said so. I will say that today, and then I'll ask for forgiveness. Recognize where your power comes from. The second thing is identify your talents and use them. Identify your talents. God obviously blessed the disciples here with different skills and talents, and God is giving you different skills and talents. If you can hear me right now, God has supernaturally gifted you to do something better than all the people around you because he loves you and he wants to use you to build up the church and to love the people inside and outside it. And if you're thinking, no, I don't really have any gifts, I'm not really good at much. Stop. Just stop it. That false humility, it gets real annoying real quick because you are good at something. It doesn't have to be up front in front of everybody, but God has gifted you with talents and skills. Do you know that? And they're all different. You can jump into Romans 12 or 1 Corinthians 12, see a whole bunch of these gifts of the Spirit that God's given us, these talents that he's given us as well. They're all over the place. So what is it that God's wired you to do? I mean, and if you don't know what it is, can I tell you the best way to figure out what your gift is if you don't know? What comes really easy to you that other people just don't seem to get? Can you look at a bunch of numbers and make sense out of that? And you're like, oh yeah, like the accountant. And you just get it, and you're like, oh, look at all these numbers. I get it. Or do you look at them and think, I don't like numbers. This is bad. Budget's bad. Spending good. You know, if you can't see that, you're probably not wired that way. Stop trying to spend all your energy that way. Maybe you're gifted, and you're wonderful at loving people. You're good at finances. You're good at singing. You're good at working with kids. Can I tell you, I love people who are supernaturally gifted to connect with families who have special needs. Oh my gosh, what an amazing gift. You get to love the coolest people in the world. That's a gift from God. Maybe it's teaching. Maybe it's leading. Maybe it's giving. Maybe it's cooking or serving behind the scenes. Maybe it's the gift of creativity. It could be anything. You have a gift. And you get to use it. I'm thankful for people in our church who have gifts. I'm thankful because it's been a blessing to me. This morning, you've been blessed. You get to look at slides. They've been put together all week. You didn't know that. It's taken time. Carol, thank you. Thank you for using the gift that God's given you of creativity. You are so unbelievably creative that it is supernatural God gift. And when I see things that make sense to me and just flow, I thank God for you. When I see our kids come in here for VBS, and there's a whole set designed where 200 kids get transported underwater, I'm thankful for you because they're experiencing the love of Jesus through looking at a yellow submarine that adults think the Beatles. But they feel like they're underwater. I'm thankful that my kids, when they know you're teaching, Jimmy freaks out because he's so excited you're his teacher. I'm thankful for that because you love my kids. I'm thankful that when I mention my Bible's completely beat up and nasty, you ask to borrow it and you bring it back to me the next week completely rebound. Why? Because God's given you a talent. He's given you a skill. He's made you so unbelievably creative, and I'm thankful for that in our church and the way it blesses every one of your art students outside our church. You have a gift. Don't waste it. Don't waste it. We also, I want to recognize the last thing really quick is be wise. You got a gift. Use it. Use it well. Don't be a dummy with your gift. God's not calling you to be abused all the time and to be taken advantage of. That's not the way this works. He's calling you to be wise. Use it with prudence. Pray for wisdom. Pray for gentleness. That's our last and final step. Pray for wisdom. He's not sending his disciples out to go be taken advantage of. He says, be wise. I like the way that Mark Bustos, if you haven't heard of him, he does something very unique with his gift. We'll close with this.
Feel good about this. I really do. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Of course.
My name is Mark Bustos. I'm a hairstylist based out of New York City. On my days off, I go out on the street and I look for homeless people to help out, whether it be a haircut or just a conversation. Just try to help out in any way to brighten someone's day.
Nice to meet you. What are you thinking about a haircut today?
Free?
Free.
No, I'm
ready to go.
I want
to
pull up.
You got a
hold on. Is this my seat?
This is your seat.
Okay.
Your seat, my friend.
And take the next step in life just by giving them a little bit more confidence or even to just walk a little taller.
I want to feel good when I go on my interview next week. And now I feel that way. I feel real good. I feel good about this.
I feel real good about this. You have a talent and a gift. You've been given power and authority from the number one placed Jesus. How will you use it this week? Will you live life generously? Will you give freely because you've been given too freely? Or will you hold on to your power, your authority, claim it as your own? I pray that at Crossbridge, we will be a church who gives freely. We will hold no ministry, no power, no authority as our own, but recognize they are all gifts from our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And we will use them wisely, with purity, And in doing so, we see people loved. And people who don't feel loved will come here and say, I feel great, not because they've been served, but because they've been loved. That's who we will be. Will you pray with me as our worship team comes back up to close us out this morning? Jesus, I thank you greatly for demonstrating to us what it means to release power and authority when you are number one. And I thank you that you are number one, because God, I feel a pressure sometimes to try to be that, and I don't have to. Thank you for that. I pray that for those here who have been abused by the use of their gifts, that they've used their gifts and they've been taken advantage of. But God, I pray that you would redeem that in their lives, that you would help them to see their wirings, their giftings. And I pray, God, that they would find a way to use that in their homes, that they'd find a way to use that in Crossbridge. God, I thank you that this is a place where if there's a gift, it could be used, and it should be used, and it will be used, but not used for us, but used for you. So God, I thank you for every person who's over in CB Kids right now that's loving on our kids. Thank you for gifting them. I thank you for every single person who plays these instruments, that you've gifted them to do this and they honor you with that. The guys with setup and with teardown and with cafe, God, thank you. Thank you. I pray that we would be a place that values others and releases to them the authority that we've been given. And in doing so, they'd find value, they'd find worth, and they would know you love them greatly. At this time, God, we give back to you, not just that way, but with our money and our time. And I pray that as we give back to you and take that time to do so, that you would take this money and you would almost, God, the picture I get is just expanding it, like continuing to help us to see this harvest that you said to the disciples, go get it. God, I pray that that would be what helps fuel us to go get it. God, thank you so much for this time together. We love you, and it's in your name we pray. Amen.